Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast, the week of March 19th. This week, we visited with Professor Thomas Weiss, who is the director of the Ralph Bunche Institute at the City University of New York Graduate Center. Professor Weiss has an article in the current issue of America looking at the international intervention in Libya in 2011. I spoke to him about that event, as well as the emerging doctrine known as the responsibility to protect. All right, let's begin. Your article in America Magazine for the week of March 19th is on the doctrine of the responsibility to protect. And let's begin by looking at Libya and what lessons are to be learned from the engagement there in 2011.
Well, for me, Libya was the human rights event of the year in the right direction for a change as opposed to the wrong direction. There was an unseemly end to the whole adventure with the militias executing the dear colonel. But until that point, it seemed to me that rarely does the international community of states come together and make a decision. In this case, they did. After 4 decades of misrule and human rights abuse, he finally really lost it, as opposed to partially losing it over the Lockerbie and other incidents, and began to menace his own population in reality, and then began using rhetoric that suggested he was serious about crushing them. And at this point, his titular friends in Africa and the Middle East dropped him like a hot potato. And the Western world, for a change, was also on the same page. The United Nations also, unusually, did not stand in the way, but actually mobilized quickly to take steps. And so I see this as a singular achievement that occasionally we can get things right.
Now, I mentioned the responsibility to protect earlier. Maybe we should define that for people who may not be familiar with it.
Well, the responsibility to protect is it's not a new norm. We've been trying to intervene to protect human beings for a long time. But it's a new and important label which says that when a state is unwilling or unable to protect its own population, or in this case was the perpetuator of the abuse, the sovereignty of that state disappears, evaporates, and no longer applies, and the responsibility to protect the citizens of that state devolves to the international community of states, ideally, not always, but ideally operating through the UN Security Council.
Now, you mentioned a success from 2011 in terms of the responsibility to protect. You also write that it was also a bad year for the responsibility to protect, in addition to being a good year in Libya. Can you talk about the negatives?
Well, certain people see this as a bad year for the same reason I see it as being a good year. And then there are negative developments or that we failed to respond elsewhere. So let me do those in two parts. Those who are not all that enamored with the idea that sovereign states have to protect their populations, the Zimbabwes, the Sudans, the Burmas, the Cubas, the Nicaraguas, the Venezuelas of this world, are quite uneasy with the notion that there is an international responsibility to come to the rescue of war victims or those suffering from crimes against humanity, or genocide, or ethnic cleansing. I'm obviously not one of those. But these states saw, rather than 2011 being the annus mirabilis, as I call it in the article, but rather the annus horribilis, for those of us who've forgotten all we learned in Jesuit schools as undergraduates. Anyway, you could also argue, however, that Libya was perhaps not even the worst of events or of countries undergoing such traumatic events. In neighboring Syria, more or less starting at the same time, we've seen a singular set of inabilities to come to any decision about anything other than the Arab League now having tried to start a peace process, having sent some human rights monitors and condemned unequivocally the Assad regime, and now the General Assembly as well. But those are pretty feeble steps when we now have 7,500 people, at least 7,500 people who've lost their lives. But if we look elsewhere in the Congo, in Darfur and now South Kordofan and Sudan. If we think about Zimbabwe over the last 10 years in which a tyrant has been crushing his people, you'd say, well, we don't actually get this right very frequently. And I would agree with that. However, we now at least occasionally get it right. Formerly, we never got it right. So for those of us who believe in glasses at least partially filled, I think we've taken some important steps in the last year.
You write that responsibility protect is often referred to as an emerging international doctrine. And you pose the question, has it fully emerged yet?
That's right.
Where are we?
Well, since the International Commission on Intervention and State Sovereignty coined this term in an important report done for the Secretary General in the year 2001, and I had the great privilege, actually, of acting as the research director, so I've been following this issue for a long time, 10 years before that report. But we call it an emerging norm because during the 1990s, we did see several instances in which outsiders came to the rescue of human beings. You could point to Somalia. You could point to Rwanda, not for what happened in April to June, but for what happened after the genocide. You could point to Kosovo. You can point to Haiti. There were a number of instances, and there was not much consistency here, in which outsiders came to the rescue, sometimes with UN approval, sometimes without UN approval. And so there was a contested notion that there was an international responsibility to do everything that sort of clashed directly with the notion of state sovereignty. The commission came up with this notion that it really was not the rights of outsiders to come to the rescue, but actually the rights of victims, the rights of people on the ground to protection and assistance, and the responsibility of outsiders to give them a hand. So this norm has now, shall I say, spread. It is supported. It was supported by a decision in 2005 on the occasion of the UN's 60th anniversary. Over 150 heads of state signed on to this agreement. However, that does not mean that everyone is signed on. I mentioned a number of states earlier. The doctrine remains contested in the sense that what is the definition of genocide? What is the definition of a crime against humanity? What is ethnic cleansing? What is, et cetera? And so while we'd like to think that reasonable men and women can come to a decision, it's not always that clear. And if my friends are suffering, I tend to recognize that more quickly than your friends. And so the norm, we say it's emerging in the sense that there are more and more states who are signing on to this, and it's after all states who end up signing treaties and making decisions to move ahead. More and more states are signing on or acquiescing, and fewer who are contesting the norm. However, that doesn't mean, as we are currently seeing in Syria, that it is uncontested. And whereas in Libya, in the Security Council, there were 5 abstentions, including Russia and China, who have veto power. In Syria to date, there have been comparable number, not quite as many abstentions, but there have been 2 negative votes by China and Russia, which make the Security Council, it's impossible for the Security Council to act.
I found it useful in your piece where you kind of go through what R2P is, as it's known, R2P, and what it isn't. Mm-hmm. And specifically, you say, although we've been talking a lot about the United Nations, R2P cannot become a synonym for everything that the UN does. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could talk about that.
Well, those of us who study bureaucracies, city bureaucracies, national bureaucracies, or in this case, international bureaucracies, are aware of a phenomenon that whatever the flavor of the month is, we would all like to use it to strengthen our hand, to get a bigger budget, to have more people working on the problem, et cetera, et cetera. And so one of the problems with a responsibility to protect is that in making it acceptable for a large number of people, the responsibility to protect has three parts, one of which is called the responsibility to prevent genocide, mass atrocities in general, to react to mass atrocities, and then to pick up the pieces or to rebuild after mass atrocities. So prevention, reaction, rebuilding. Unfortunately, you could say that everything that the United Nations does is a form of prevention. You'd like things not to get so bad that people resort to armed conflict. So drilling a well means that perhaps someday we will not be fighting over a common water hole, and you get the picture. So that if the responsibility to protect means absolutely everything that the United Nations and other international organizations, everything that they do, then it really has no sharp edge to it. And one of the reasons that the responsibility to protect had a sharp edge is it had a focus. We're talking about mass atrocities and the kinds of prevention immediately preceding mass atrocities and the kind of post-conflict peace building immediately after armed conflict or mass atrocities to prevent us from going back to page one and starting mass atrocities again. And what's happened is that lots of people have tried to expand it to include, I'll caricature here, you know, the Inuits from global warming. Of course, we have a responsibility to do something. It's just that you can't mobilize states in a narrow set of exercises if you're trying to do everything. So one of the advantages of the emerging norm of the responsibility to protect is that it has a focus. It's narrow. It has a sharp edge. And it doesn't mean everything to every man and woman.
And you mentioned the sharp edge. You know, in Libya, that that meant some military action. But as you also write, it's not always just about military action. The preventive piece is important.
Absolutely. And this is what actually distinguishes the responsibility to protect from what we used to call humanitarian intervention. And the idea that there are different phases and different responsibilities actually helps to confuse the debate. I used to, and I lost this rhetorical battle, I actually said what we're really talking about in the responsibility to react is military intervention. We're really talking about the sharp end of the R2P stick. So why don't we call it that? But I think my colleagues rightfully so said, well, listen, that expression was so contested. It was so hot. It made hair stand on end on so many heads that if we do this, it'll provide the tool to dismiss the whole concept. And so I graciously accepted, and I think they were right. But it seems to me that one needs to talk about various steps and not shy away from the fact that, yes, we're talking about prevention. Yes, we're talking about peace building. But yes, we are also talking about occasionally using military force. And in fact, if you threaten, seriously threaten, not sort of mumble and actually have no intention of using it, those threats actually make the consideration of other measures, other kinds of preventive measures, far more likely to succeed and be taken seriously.
You mentioned in your piece something I was not familiar with, which is the new establishment of the Atrocity Prevention Board by the Obama administration. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Yes, well, one of the things that we've been trying to do with we, that is those of us interested in the responsibility to protect, including something called the Global Center for the Responsibility to Protect, which is located, truth and packaging here, at the institute I direct. But one of the things we've been trying to do is that we need to institutionalize, that is, find someone who is responsible within government ministries and government bureaucracies for the responsibility to protect. So if there is a mass atrocity going on, or if there's one being threatened, let's say Libya in February as opposed to March, There is a phone number. There is a fax number. There's an email address. And so in some ways, the United States has gone the furthest towards institutionalizing this measure, in that there's an interdepartmental bureaucracy set up, so that when something like Libya develops at Syria in the present moment, there are a group of people meeting to try to coordinate reactions across the State Department, the Defense Department, Population Resources, and Refugees part of the State Department, etc. So you have a phone number to call, and the president has someone he can rely upon. Other countries have not gone that far. They have set up something called a focal point, which means that there's at least a person in a crisis who is responsible for trying to get reactions from other parts of the bureaucracy. So in some ways, the United States has taken the lead in this institutionalization process.
We've mentioned Syria at a couple points, but maybe you could talk a little more detail. Obviously, things are going on so quickly there. You mentioned the veto by China and Russia, also the action by the Arab League. What are some of the other fronts the international community is working on?
Well, to say the obvious, every case is sui generis. And Syria is not Libya for a whole host of reasons. One, it's actually surrounded by a whole series of six other countries who are part of this equation in the Middle East. So a reaction there is considerably more difficult. The Syrian army is better trained, more together, involves fewer mercenaries, has better equipment from the Russians who have been selling it there for decades. The opposition, loosely described, is far less coherent, far less organized, and it is not in a particular location within Syria, which makes it a little harder to support any of this. Or alternatively, it makes it easier for the regime, in this case the Assad regime, to use its own military against its own people. So at present, we have a lot of high decibel level diplomacy going on. We have the Arab League, which does not have a history until Libya of taking stances, tough stances against member states, which has condemned Syria in totally unequivocal terms. We've had the Human Rights Council of the UN do the same thing. We've had the General Assembly of the UN, in an even more surprising move from my point of view, take Syria to task. We have now some humanitarian aid trickling in on the borders. There are mixed reports about whether the International Committee of the Red Cross is being able to get various kinds of emergency goods to people, medicine and clothing and housing. And there's a report today that, in fact, that the Security Council is considering a resolution related to purely humanitarian affairs. It's difficult to say people should die of starvation and defend that publicly, although we've had lots of people do so. But anyway, it's hard to do that in the Security Council. So a resolution is circulating about the access of victims, and the regime will probably say they're also terrorists, the access of terrorists to international humanitarian assistance is a human right, is guaranteed. And it seems that both the representative of the Arab League, namely Kofi Annan, who is the retired Secretary General, but who will be representing the Arab League, and the head of the UN's humanitarian operations across agencies, name is Valerie Amos, who is the emergency relief coordinator, both of them will be in Damascus and elsewhere in Syria. They're supposed to be leaving today, so they should be there soon. So the question is whether this will actually help in the delivery of humanitarian assistance, or whether this is just another effort by the regime to buy time.
Well, we should say we're talking on Tuesday, March 6th, and this should be going up this week. So just to give you some time information. Finally, you know, the whole question of never again when it comes to genocide or human rights abuses, that's a lofty goal, but are we kind of creeping a little closer to that?
Well, I wouldn't be in this business, I think, if I didn't think that. I suppose I'm an inveterate optimist on this score. That expression was, of course, coined after World War II in the face of the Holocaust. And so the slogan "never again" was used. Of course, depending on your definition of mass atrocity, we've certainly uttered that on several occasions, perhaps most clearly with the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, as we saw estimates of 1.5 million people, just to pick a number, died as a result of official policy. And then in Rwanda, most people say between 800,000, 900,000, maybe 1 million people in a country that had only 8 million who were eliminated in the clearest case of genocide we've had since. So we've seen those events. So those of us who think that mass atrocities should not be a public policy option have become somewhat buoyed by the notion that occasionally states can act. Somalia, even though the we're still suffering from the chaos 20 years later, that the U.S. effort in Somalia to halt that carnage in 1992 was a kind of response that we'd like to see. And once again in Libya. So occasionally we can say never again and actually mean it. My goal obviously is to say never again, never again. But that's an aspiration, not a reality at this point in time.
Well, Professor Thomas Weiss, director of the Ralph Bunche Institute for International Studies, we want to thank you very much.
Thank you.